The following episode may contain inappropriate material. Listener discretion is advised.
Hey everybody, this is Daryl Banks, co-creator of Green Lantern Kyle Rayner, and you're listening to the PVD Cast.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another installment of the PVD Cast. I am your humble host and your podcast purveyor, John Orlando, and welcome to episode number 355. I hope all is well with you out there, and thank you very much for checking out this edition of the PVD Cast. Now, before I start talking about what to expect with this episode, I want to mention a couple of upcoming appearances I have booked. I'm going to be doing some ring announcing this Saturday, November 5th. The Buckeye Wrestling Alliance, BWA, is back in action in Newark, Ohio. VFW Post 1060, 7 o'clock bell time. Check out their Facebook page. Just search for Buckeye Wrestling Alliance. If you happen to be in the area and you want to check out some wrestling, there you go. You can definitely get all the information right off their Facebook page. And then the following Friday, Veterans Day, no doubt, November 11th, I will be back working with OWA, back at the commentary table for the Fight for Pride event. It's emanating from the King of Clubs complex in Columbus, Ohio. 8:30 bell time for that one. For more information, just check out at Ohio Wrestling A1 throughout any social media platform. All right. So my guests for this installment are two legendary comic book creators. As a matter of fact, that was the name of the panel, the Legendary Comics Creators panel that I helped run and produce in Monroe, Michigan for the Monroe Pop Fest back in September. Last week, you got a little taste of the panel for pro wrestling and comics with Al Snow, Rhino, and the guys from Broken Icon Comics. Well, this time around, I talked to two legends of the industry. Don Simpson, who, of course, is best known for the creation of Megaton Man, and James O'Barr, the man behind The Crow. And it was such a great opportunity to sit down with these two gentlemen and talk about how the industry has changed throughout the years. And also, you know, it's great to hear from them as to where they think the industry is going. And I would like to throw it out there that Arvel Jones was scheduled to be part of this panel as well, but Friday evening, he was not around at the Monroe Pop Fest. He didn't show up till Saturday, and so it's unfortunate that we didn't get a chance to talk to Arvel, but Arvel Jones and I did sit down a couple of years ago in 2019, episode 207 to be exact, and we did chat about his career in comics, including his start in the biz and co-creating Misty Knight and a lot of other great topics. So jump back into the archives, look up episode 207 and give it a listen. But for the time being, I'm going to talk real quickly about a great sponsor of this podcast. Of course, I'm talking about World's Greatest Comics. They're located at 5974 Westerville Road in Westerville, Ohio, and they have tons of comics from every era, the gold, the silver, the bronze, and even the modern era. They have graphic novels, they have toys, they have comic book supplies, hundreds upon hundreds of back issues, various collectibles. They got you covered for anything that you need for your comic book fandom. So stop on over to the store, and as I mentioned, they're located at 5974 Westerville Road in Westerville, Ohio. Or you could check them out online. Their website is wgcomics.com, or they're pretty active on their Facebook page. Just search for at WGComics. All right, with that little bit out of the way, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to throw it to a quick break, and on the other side of the break, you're going to hear my panel discussion with legendary comic creators James O'Barr and Don Simpson.
welcome to the Legendary Comics Creators panel. My name is John Orlando. I am joined by two individuals who probably need no introduction, but I certainly will still give them that introduction. To my right, the creator of Megaton Man, Mr. Don Simpson. Don, how are you?
Good, how you doing?
I'm doing well. And of course, to my left, the man that is behind the crow, Mr. James O'Barr. James, how are you?
Good.
So let's start off, first of all, just talking a little bit about yourselves. James, I'd like to just ask you this first question. From what the story has been with the crow was that you wrote the story, you had it all set to go, and then it sat for a while. Was that correct? It sat for a good amount of time, 5-6 years?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I sent out sample pages to every company that was out there, and no one was interested. They didn't understand it. It was too dark, moody, and violent, and there were no superheroes in it, so literally no one was interested.
Did you ever fear that it would never get published?
No, that was never my intention when I started.
Okay.
It was just something for me. And it was a learning process as they went along, too.
Don, let's talk a little bit about how you created Megaton Man, all right? So give us a little bit of the backstory about when you sat down and was like, I'm going to create this character. Like, what was going through your mind at the time?
Okay, well, it's great to be back in Michigan. This is where I created Megaton Man. I was living in Detroit in the early 1980s, and I was washing dishes in a restaurant at Union Street on Woodward Avenue down by the medical center. And there was a lot of the Cold War had been kind of brought back by Reagan, and at the time there was the nuclear freeze movement, there was neutron bombs and Minuteman missiles and, in the news all the time. And I thought of a character called Megaton Man. Megaton is a unit of measurement for the explosive force of nuclear warheads. Mm-hmm. So a 20 megaton bomb would flatten the city and so forth. So I was washing dishes in a restaurant and just drawing at night, and made photocopies. I got about 15 rejections from publishers in those days: Eclipse, Fantagraphics, Aardvark Vanaheim, First Comics, a lot of publishers that are no longer in existence. But the ironic thing is that, Fantagraphics is going to be doing the collection next year. So they had originally rejected Megaton Man back in 84. So that's how I got started. The publisher that did publish it at the time was Kitchen Sink Press in Wisconsin.
Who also ended up publishing The Crow, too.
And that's our connection.
You mentioned Detroit. Detroit, of course, Jim Starlin, Al Milgrom, Arvell Jones as well. Keith Pollard, who I understand Keith was a kind of a role model for you.
Well, I didn't meet Jim Starlin or Al Milgrom at the time. In fact, I didn't meet Jim Starlin until just a couple of years ago. But I met, there was a fellow named James Malone who was a African-American cartoonist in the Michigan Chronicle at the time, and he put me in touch with Keith and Arvell, and so in high school I was lucky enough to meet the guy who was drawing Spider-Man at the time and Fantastic Four and a few other things. Then later he did the Vigilante for DC.
Yes, yep.
I'm talking about Keith. And I used to hang around with Arvell's advertising studio, which was by the GM building, Burroughs building up there in the New Center area. So yeah, they were very encouraging.
Well, let's talk a little bit about maybe some of the changes that you have seen over the years of doing comics. What differences have you seen maybe in the production aspect of comics? James, do you want to start first with that?
How did digital change the music industry? There's so many aspects you could look at.
Well, we were talking about art supplies that aren't there anymore. There were a lot of techniques that you would
You can buy a program that will imitate those arc tricks, but you can't buy the Zipitone or the stuff we used to use.
We used to use all these commercial arc techniques of...
that were around since the 30s.
You had little dot screens on adhesive-back acetate that you would apply to the artwork.
It was very labor-intensive. You had to cut it all out with an X-Acto knife in the exact shape you wanted, and then spend all day cutting out all these figures to realize you got the goddamn Zipitone backwards.
Oh, did you cut it out on the sheet? And then...
Yeah.
You didn't use that technique, huh?
Oh, I used Zipitone, but James was talking about how his early issues of Le Crow would use like $300 worth of Zipitone, and he was getting peanuts from publishers.
Well, I didn't know you could order it right from Crafton, I think was making it at the time, so I would go up to Dick Blick's on Michigan Avenue, and I would just buy whatever they had, you know, and... A lot of it was just like patterns and weird things I would never use. So, but when I got with the people at Caliber, they're like, we're putting in an order for Zipitone. So, but, you know, I pretty much took one of everything out of their catalog.
Well, not only has the digital changed the art, the actual making of the artwork.
Zipitone is the gray tones you see in black and white comics.
So you can do that kind of stuff now with Photoshop.
Yeah.
It's also changed just the distribution of comics.
Yeah, sure. Everything about comics has changed, you know. Now, comics are subservient to films, you know.
And, yeah.
I would think most of the comic books you see out there today, that you could buy, you know, the brand new stuff that people have, are print-on-demand digital files. Yeah,
it should be a golden age for independence now with print-on-demand, but it's just not happening. You know, I was talking to Robert Rodriguez about this, and he said, the digital camera is going to break it wide open for filmmakers. Anybody can make a movie now. And he was all excited about it, and it just never happened. Now, you know, you can put together your own comic, you can do it all yourself and send it off to, you know, Kapow or one of these places, and they'll print 1 or 10,000 copies, whatever you want. Whereas back in our day, we had to go to a real printer, you know, who took photographs of our artwork and then transferred them to the silver plates or tin plates or something, and it was very labor intensive, and you had to print at least 3,000 to 5,000 copies of everything, so it should be a golden age for independence.
Does anybody here make comics? Have you heard want to make comics? Trying to break into the industry?
Let us discourage you.
Want to be a writer?
Yeah, I teach creative writing at Eastern Michigan.
Okay.
Okay. I want to do comics.
Okay. So what do you see in students that want to break into comics? What are their expectations these days?
It seems like a lot of them are so focused on the digital part. Like you said, a lot of them are going to graphic design and starting there before they even sell them. Put a pencil and paper, and they couldn't draw to save their lives, but they're working digital first because they know that even if they can draw on paper, it might not transfer over. They have to have that digital file. It's almost like a necessity in the world, and I know it stresses some of them out because I get a lot of the older students that have been drawing for years with digital. They're not picking up as quick. So,
are they trying? As James was saying, are they trying to create IP to sell to Hollywood?
Yeah, the main motivation seems to be to get a movie made or a TV. Miniseries made of your country, you know? And I've seen people that got like 1 to 2 issues of something out, you know, and I, you know, it's like you need to build up a story and a legacy and characters that, you know, that films can exploit. And my favorite one was, I was at San Diego one year, and there's these guys that had this character called the Red Ant, and I don't, you know, and they had costumes, and they had sent away from had models made of everything and movie posters, but then we didn't have a comic yet.
So they were all set.
Hollywood to come knocking, but they didn't even have a story or a comic book, an artist.
Well, what were your expectations before you had your experience with Hollywood?
That was my next question. What, what your experience is like, you know, dealing with the machine, so to speak.
I did one or two things for Marvel and Dark Horse and stuff, but I never got, because I just don't do superheroes. It's not, doesn't appeal to me. And so I never got drawn into that, you know. I wanted to write and draw my own stories, and, you know, luckily I apparently have some kind of mass appeal that you know, that works for me. So I never had to draw Spider-Man for 30 issues to pay the rent. Or
did you ever, were you, I should rephrase that, were you very super surprised that you were getting the attention for the Crow and that, you know,
well,
Hollywood wanted an option?
A really big part of it was the Tim Burton Batman movie came out, and suddenly comics were cool again,
yeah.
And so Hollywood
yeah.
was buying up everything they could. And the Crow just kind of got swept up in one of those because, oh, it's a little black and white independent. There's no flying people. We could make this cheap, you know. So I just thought, you know, it was $1,000. I just thought, oh, it's free money, you know. This is the first money I ever made off my comic. And within 2 years it was in production, which is unheard of in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it got in the hands of the right people.
Okay. Maybe, since we're kind of talking about the corporations of making a movie and whatnot, I'd like to just kind of maybe go back, and maybe, Don, you can help out with this. Was it kind of a more laid-back environment, say, in the 80s when it comes to dealing with people from DC and Marvel, the big two, or is it just as stressful now or then as it is now?
Well,
have you heard or seen or know of anybody that's, you know...
I've had kind of an unusual career. I think both of us have
sure.
kind of unusual careers, but in different respects. So I really don't know how you go about breaking in today, flat out, or what the big companies are looking for. I can tell you there are people from my era who won't work for Marvel or DC because their pay is kind of just
it hasn't reversed. Changed since the 70s.
It's just kind of going in reverse. The big royalty checks of the 90s and all stuff is going away, so I don't know what people's expectations are.
Okay, would that even go
as James? You know, the conventional wisdom would be that you draw Spider-Man for 30 issues, you get a following, and then you can write your own ticket, right? But I don't know if that still holds true or not.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are some artists out there who make a name for themselves, and you know, Gordon Parlov and Issad Ribic, who they're phenomenal artists, and they started at, you know, and then they kind of branched off to do their own things. So it can be a platform if you want to show off what you're capable of.
Going back to what you said, Don, is you don't know what the big two are looking for.
They don't know what they're looking for.
I was just going to say something along those lines. Like, is it?
They're looking for a bestseller that costs them nothing.
Okay.
it's right now the standard. And you know, it's just like they can hire a kid in Argentina to pencil and ink a book for $90 a page, which is a lot of money for him
mm-hmm.
in Argentina.
Sure,
but that's starvation wages for us, you know. And I'm not saying they're not good, because there's a lot of really phenomenal artists, you know, Edward Rizzo, you know, the Fiumera brothers. There's some really amazing talent out there. But it's a world economy now, and I don't know how we can compete in that.
That's something that I don't think I've ever heard another creator say, to be honest with you, James. I never thought about the idea that it's more global than that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
with the internet, it's just like they never have to step foot in Marvel's offices. Everything is done digitally, sent you know, over the internet, and they don't even have to speak English, you know, if they can get a good translation of what they're working on. So, and like I said, there's some really, really incredibly talented people out there.
So you think it's positive that we have this technological infrastructure that we could do this?
Well, absolutely. There's no reason, a kid from Argentina has to move to New York and struggle anymore, you know.
Particularly since the publishers aren't there anymore.
Right.
They're in
Hollywood now. Yeah.
I'll tell you one thing that's really changed is you heard James talk about superheroes. That was the mainstream thing, and then there was this alternative thing. And I think the sense I get today is that there's not this kind of boundary, this political divide between, you know, you work for Fantagraphics, or you work for Dark Horse, or you work for some underground or alternative label versus doing superheroes. I see people today, I'm thinking of like Jim Rugg, Ed Pisker, the kayfabe, cartoonist kayfabe guys who incidentally have been promoting my work, my old 90s work. Like it was going out of style.
They have a real love.
But they do. They're doing like they're doing the Hulk, and they're doing what's it called? The Hulk Grand Design and X-Men Grand Design, and then they do their alternative stuff, which is just they don't see any boundary between those two things. And there's another artist in Pittsburgh, Lizzie Solomon, who you probably never heard of, but she does. Her independent comics, and then she does contemporary art in galleries. And again, there's no stigma, there's no boundary. She just does her thing. She just does some things that are comics. She prints them up, and then she does these installations surrounding things. And I just see, I think it's a generational thing where today's creators don't see the stigmas. Partly, and I think that's because all the sales figures have dropped down to the same level. So whether you're doing Spider-Man or whether you're doing your own little home-cooked thing, it's all
yeah.
just...
Yeah, 30,000 copies now is a hit book.
You know? Oh, and, yeah.
You know, unless it was selling 800,000 back in the 90s, nobody wanted to even touch it. So it's... And I'm not saying standards have dropped, but what makes a hit book... it's, you know, I read, you know, like in the 90s there was 35,000 comic book stores in the U.S. and now there's less than 3,000, you know, and you have to actively go search out where this comic book store is. You know, it's an effort to go in and to follow the same book every month, you know, whether you got a pull list or not. It's, you still have to make the effort to go to this comic book store and get it. And most of the rest of the world is, you know, used to having things at their fingertips now.
And I always stated this, that I'm in my mid-40s, but I remember as a kid, there was a reason you got every single issue, because it would take forever for a collection to come out. I mean, it would take years.
Well, they didn't
sometimes.
Even do collections for a long time.
Right. But now it's like, hey, this run of X-Men's done, and guess what? Here's the collection of it, and it came out
the next
2 months.
Yeah.
Yeah, the very next month. So there's no, to me, as a fan of comics, I've switched from buying independent issues, single issues. There's no reason to. I just buy the collections because...
And there's extra artwork in the back. There's notes, there's sketches. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think they've kind of been their own worst enemy, the companies that are doing this, instead of, you know, making you wait. Don, can I come back to you real quick? You said that, you know, you were talking about the independence and that. You had Fiasco Comics for a while, correct? So talk to us a little bit about why you decided to kind of create your own imprint, I guess would be the best descriptor for it, and how you felt like you did things differently than other companies.
Well, again, this was an industry that was dominated by companies. There were very few when I broke in. There was maybe Dave Sim Publishing Cerebus. Wendy and Richard Peeney at Warp Graphics were doing ElfQuest. Yeah. There were a few people self-publishing. but then came Jeff Smith and Matt Wagner and a whole generation of people. And a bunch of us, especially those of us who made some money from Image Comics from that first year of booming sales, so then I started self-publishing. And this was after years of doing stuff for Kitchen Sink Press or for Fantagraphics. I had the money to waste on self-publishing. Steve Bissett's, Rick Veach had money to do their independent things. They'd done Swamp Thing for DC. And so suddenly everybody was self-publishing.
Well, the Turtles kind of made that all possible for us.
Right.
True. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The Turtles came out, it's a little black and white independent book, and it's selling 6 million copies, you know. All because Tom Brokaw mentioned it on the evening news, and it was a clever name, you know. But, you know, stores saw these books can sell, so they started watching the independents.
Because it's too depressing, number one, so...
Well, the other thing is, when I was self-publishing, and this was before the internet, you could be putting out your 10th issue, your 12th issue, and retailers were so swamped with various titles, various offerings, and they would just tell their customers, oh, that was canceled, or that never came out, or you know, and you had no real way to communicate directly with fans. Now you definitely have that, although everybody's communicating. Everybody, so it's kind of everybody's publishing. Everybody sells about 30 copies now. It's, that's the way it goes.
I'm going to interrupt this conversation just to talk to you all about the great sponsor of the PVD Cast, World's Greatest Comics. They are your one-stop shop for all your comic book-related needs. They've got single issues, collections, graphic novels, toys, collectibles, hundreds upon hundreds of back issues. So you need not to waste any time. You need to stop on over to the store. They're located at 5974 Westerville Road in Westerville, Ohio, or check them out online. WGComics.com is their website, and they're pretty active on their Facebook page. Just search for at WG Comics.
Well, can I just real quickly, one other thing I would like to talk real quick, Don. You also, much like you mentioned, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the young lady's name out of Pittsburgh that you said.
Lizzie Solomon.
Lizzie Solomon. You mentioned that she's also doing her own thing in art installations and whatnot. But for a time period, am I correct that you were working on some other things too, like working for the Pittsburgh Pirates and Kennywood Park in Pittsburgh? And am I right?
Well, I did.
What was that? Were you still making comics at that time, or did you take
that
a time
was,
out?
That was a, there was a time where I was trying to make it as a freelance illustrator. Excuse me, I have a little tickle.
Didn't you go back to art school at one point too?
I did. And there's an even longer period, dark period of time when I actually went back and I got a PhD in art history, which is another, that and $4 will get me a cup of coffee. But, I was lost in that. But, yeah, what was the question again? Lizzie Solomon.
Yeah, and just, you know, you're working in you know, for the Pittsburgh Pirates and Kennywood and the Pittsburgh Post.
Well, that was all.
Things that were more...
Were you supplementing the comics, or yes. Did you just take a different...
No, that was... I was out of comics by that point. It was the late 90s, early 2000s. And I was doing a lot of stuff with a PR firm. I did a BrightNet, which I think was a Cleveland-based... Mm-hmm. ISP, internet service provider, and I did a Progressive Insurance comic. But there were...
Was Flo in it?
No, this is good. Before Flo. I'd like to have gotten royalties for that. But the funny thing was, and I could never get... if you're not familiar with my work, Megaton Man is a satire, so a parody of superheroes. But I could never get mainstream superhero work. Few little things here and there, but in advertising, I could actually do serious superheroes. So I did a kind of science fiction thing where they're all insurance. There was a big thing in the early 2000s where companies where Bluetooth was still in the future and nobody knew what it was, but like wireless. Wireless was this thing, and everybody thought, yeah, let's get a comic book promotion. We have a superhero that's wireless. And so I must have done three or four pitches of Wireless Man, because this was gonna, you know, you're gonna be able to move around your office with your computer and you have meetings.
Talk at the urinal.
Can I ask that? Just go with me on this. When you went in for the interview, did they go, oh, we love Megaton Man, you won, you didn't have... Everybody else that's here for the interview, just go home. Yeah. Megaton Man is here. Goodbye. Go. Leave.
Did you have to audition?
Yeah.
No, you just showed your portfolio.
Okay.
Mostly it was like somebody else canceled and they needed somebody.
Okay.
I don't think they weren't comic book fans.
Okay, that's what I was getting at. Yeah, were they?
Al Williamson turned it down.
They were just
get done.
They were just advertising people, and sometimes they would write it, and they did not know how to write comics, so they would say, you know, panel one, character comes into the room, sits down, opens the window, you know, checks the filing cabinet. It's like, no, that's not, you can't do that all in one panel. You have to explain to people that's not a comic book script, but that's, you know.
Hey, speaking of the creative process, and this is something that I'm always interested in when I talk to creators, what was it like when you were working on The Crow or when you were working on Megaton Man or any of your other projects? What was it like a typical week? Like, did you sit down on Monday, we're going to do this, and then Tuesday, we're going to move to this? And, or was it, there was no pattern to it? You just did whatever you felt you needed to get done that day.
Well, you're talking about...
I had a full-time day job.
Okay.
Southgate Ford, and making good money there. And then I would come home and draw until like midnight, because that's where my real passion was.
Okay.
My day job kept me mad enough to keep drawing, you know.
What'd you do at Southgate
Ford? I worked in parts and body shop. I did that for 12 years, so it was a long time. But I, you know, my passion was always art, so I'd come home and work on comics all night. I'm a very patient wife, so.
Did your co-workers at the Ford facility,
they
had no idea? No? Okay.
No, they knew I could draw sexy girls in the Bondo dust.
Okay.
Well, in my case, I had no idea when the week began.
I didn't give up my day job till I got the check from the movie company.
Okay.
Well, I was just saying, I really didn't know what day of the week it was. I was writing. I didn't know when the weekend came or when. It was just.
Do you think that facilitates a quicker burnout when you're just totally immersed in?
Well, it's not good for mental health. No, it's not. The only people you see are the FedEx people or the UPS driver, or you go to the comic book store once a week to pick up stuff. And that was.
I used to drive to the FedEx airplane hangar at Metro Airport there. They knew me there. I would drive right up to the airplane hangar and hand it to the guy.
Wow. That was clearly before 9/11.
Yes.
Clearly. That's not happening now. So where do you two want to see comics go in the future?
I don't know. The Emmy Awards?
Okay. Done.
That's an interesting question. I myself, I don't know.
Well, I wanted them to fulfill their potential like they have in Europe, to where they're a real art form.
Okay.
But I just don't, we still think of, you know, it's a ghetto medium here in the U.S. And I don't think the success of the superhero movies has changed the idea of that either. You know, they're popcorn movies, so it's, you know, and they're capable of telling any type of story. So, you know, and when I'm in Europe, I'm treated like a real artist. Had my artwork hung in a museum in Rome with Michelangelo sketches below me and Leonardo sketches above me, and I could never see that happening here.
We don't have too many Michelangelos over here, but wow, that's great.
Could I interrupt? I'm sorry. When you saw that, were you like, oh my god? Like, were you, I mean, you had to have been taken back.
Totally unworthy. I'm like, what do you know? And they had taken, like, it was an incredible art exhibit, you know? And it was after the movie came out, so, the girl was really popular. And they had taken pages and panels from the comic book and blown them up, like, 100 feet tall. And it was impressive, you know, when you see your artwork that big. And it still holds together, you know?
Yeah.
But I was just like, I don't belong here. You know, I felt totally out of place. In fact, when I was going in, I had my leather jacket on, and all punked out. And there's soldiers out there with machine guns, and they didn't want to let me in. No, it's my exhibit. It's my exhibit. See, James.
Don, go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean
where
to.
Where do I see comics go? Well, I can only, the older I've got, I'm only concerned with my own stuff, so I don't know what people, what possibilities people see. Like I said, I think there's more of a breakdown of taboos and boundaries. I think people are seeing not only like the mainstream independent, those lines have been blurred for some time, but I think also just media. I think when I was growing up, there were good comic books, there were good TV shows, good paperback books, there were good toys, but not all the same thing, if you know what I'm saying. Back in the 60s and 70s, Star Trek, for example, was a great TV show. They had a paperback line. The paperback company didn't even use the logo from the TV show, you know, stuff like that. There was no sense of cross-platform branding or anything. And I grew up with the idea that if you want to do a good comic book, just think of a good comic book idea. Don't think about movies. Don't think about toys, because they would have to change it so much anyway. But now, I think I'm thinking very differently because they've done it so successfully since Lord of the Rings, Peter Jackson, and Harry Potter, and the Marvel movies. They can clearly take source material and do it faithfully. So I think it's a different ballgame now, and it certainly affected my.
But they've already strip mined all that source material, so there's no new storylines for them to adapt anymore. They've already strip mined 50 years worth of DC comics. What else is there? And they're not fostering these people to do like 50 issue runs of a comic.
Mm-hmm.
Or Gene Colan, 80 issues of Daredevil. They just, it's usually 10 issue increments, so the artist and the writer don't get too much power.
I also
read somebody wants a raise because they got the best selling book. So that's why they alter the art team and the writing team like every 10, 12 issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, I also think too, when you talk about James strip mining the material, I think that goes along with something that I've had a private conversation about is, I feel like we need, as fans of comics, we need some breathing room. Because it seems like, especially Disney Plus, machine guns out, all of those things, and I actually stated it in the summer, I'm overwhelmed, with everything that's out there.
They start to blur together.
Right, and agreed, 100%. Well, hey, do you remember? No, I kind of don't remember when that happened in Ms. Marvel. I watched it, but I don't remember it because we're getting to a point where I feel like we're almost on the edge of being burned out as comic book fans. And I think that that's a real detriment to the industry.
Getting burned out of the Marvel movies and
absolutely
getting tired of it.
Yeah, I'm not the only one that has that opinion,
actually,
right?
Disney Plus machine, it just cranks and cranks and cranks.
Can you just give us 3 weeks off?
That's exactly what I said.
Yeah, they crank out super,
The Mandalorian and some really entertaining stuff, too.
Yeah.
By something, by rights or politics or anything going on.
It's entertaining, but I feel like there's a certain threshold that's being passed with how much.
Okay.
In production.
Yeah, and I feel the same. But that's the whole thing. It's there's no stopping point.
Years and years in advance. It's insane.
And I
have a release date before they've even started filming.
And I wonder when is it going to be that, we tip the apple cart, so to speak.
Well, it's because nobody's happy with just making a profit on a film now. They all want to make $100 million.
Right. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
They all want a blockbuster. 60s and 70s, it's like if your movie paid for itself, it was a success.
All right, well, as we're getting close to wrapping things up, folks have any questions for Don or for James? Go ahead.
I have a question for you, James, about Gothic. What was the story behind the production of that, how that all came along? Because it's something that isn't properly written about or talked about.
Gothic was a fully hand-painted, and this was during the hype of the cyberpunk era, with, and I was f- friends with William Gibson and John Shirley and those guys, and I wanted to do my version of a cyberpunk story. And so I worked on it for a year, year and a half. And that was while the Crow movie was out playing, and I signed a contract with Pressman Studios, and once I saw how they had treated me with the Crow, there was no impetus for me to finish this thing because they were just going to take it and do whatever they wanted with it. So it kind of, you know, technology just incrementally, you know, doubles every 6 months. So, you know, I got people using CD drives and things, and it's just like, that's, you know, I didn't anticipate a thumb drive or, you know, any of this. So it almost becomes like a satire of technology. After I think 40, 50 pages of it, it's just like, I just couldn't pour all myself into this to just hand it over to a studio who was going to, you know, try to get Johnny Depp to star in it.
Any other questions for Don or James?
Just a real quick comment, and it's something I hope that you two as artists are seeing. Something we've known as fans since, you know, we've been reading comics, but I think it took a long time for the world to catch up, and I think the Marvel stuff has kind of pushed that back because of the popcorn flick. But I think comics are finally starting to get respected a little more as literature, as art.
Definitely,
so,
they are.
My actual master's is in lit. I teach creative writing, but I also teach literature class, and I actually teach some of the Crow. I teach things like Sandman, and not just because they're beautiful art, but for the writing itself, it's just beautiful prose. And I think people are finally, we're in a generation where people are starting to come around. There's a lot of universities that are now doing this that are showing that, look, these things can be appreciated for the stories that they have, but they're not just this beautiful, pretty thing to look at, but there's so much substance there that, so I hope you're seeing that as artists as well, that your work.
I don't see a lot of like Don and I both, you know, we wrote and drew our own stuff, and I don't see a lot of that, you know, one man teams. David Lapham maybe with Straight Bullets, but no, the opportunities there, and there are a lot of, you know, Ed Brubaker and, you know, Garth Ennis wrote some really excellent books, you know, that I think approach literature.
Any other questions? Or?
I have another one for you about the Zeitgeist drawing that is on, I believe it's on the cover of your sketchbook. How did that all come about in your mind?
Did you have any dealings with Northstar? No. It was a small publishing company out of Chicago. They had this incredibly irritating guy named Andrew Rev who ran the thing, and he would just call and talk, and, you know, 100 miles an hour, and I would just set the phone down and go play with the cat for a while and come back, and I could still hear him, you know, like he could fast talk you into anything. And so I'm like, cool, just do what you do, you know, and we'll print it. So I did like three chapters of this thing called Zeitgeist, and basically what it was Thor and Loki, not from the Marvel comics, but throughout history, trying to kill each other, you know. So this thing took place over 2,000 years, and they're fighting over a girl, which I thought, you know, because I never say their names or anything, but there's enough hints there to where there's enough Easter egg where you should be able to figure it out. But I would get a check from Andrew Rev, and they're called conditional checks, and on the back of it says, by endorsing this check, you agree to do 100 more pages of artwork for North Star Hope. And I'm like, first of all, the bank ain't going to cash this because they can't guarantee I'm going to do 100 more pages. So he, after three segments, you know, something like 40 pages, three covers, I couldn't get a check that was worth a shit from them. So me and a friend, we took the train to Chicago, and I went down there and bullied my way in the door and got my artwork back from them. And And they did the same thing to Grendel, Matt Wagner. They did the same thing with Matt. You know, they wouldn't pay him. They tried to say they owned it. But, you know, they're gone. They're out of business now. But that was one of those things where I just can't keep, you know, putting all this time, effort, and these expensive art supplies into something that's not paying.
And that's how we became legends.
Well, Don, I think we stop right there. You win on that one.
There was a question back there.
Go ahead.
A quick question. So, James, the kind of a little nerdy question, of course, but when they picked up your comic for Crow, what was your honest reaction when you found out that Brandon Lee was going to be portraying?
They had me go in and meet Brandon Lee, and they showed me Rapid Fire, which he had just done. I don't know if it was out yet. And he was just super sweet, super nice guy. You know, very, very humble. And I had talked to the producers afterwards. I'm like, I don't know. You know, he's obviously he can do the physical stuff. He looks right. Nice. You know, I can't. He's supposed to be frightening and scary and half out of his mind. And, so I was hesitant, you know. But what they did, a makeup test and a wardrobe test, and he nailed it from there. He was a big fan of the comic. And in fact, he just came into the studio and said, "I heard you're making a movie out of this comic. I want to try out for it." He wasn't on anybody's list. They had like Johnny Depp and this guy Billy Worth from The Lost Boys.
Okay.
And River Phoenix too, right?
I think River was on there.
Who was on your list? Did you have a list in particular for that role?
Not especially. You know, I mean, later on when they were talking about the remakes, I thought Cillian Murphy would be perfect. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, he's getting a little long in the tooth now, but. You know, he's beautiful and he can be deadly threatening at the same time.
Well, Don, James, would you like everybody to know, or would you like to tell everybody maybe
what
you
keep tabs on?
You're not selling anything. Okay. No. No social media, no website, nothing like that. You know what?
Actually, there's a fan site called, it wasn't me, Crowbar.
I had to preface that
with an apostrophe after the O and two R's, and it's an art site, a fan art site, and they post stuff, a lot of shit that I wish would just disappear because I had no idea what I was doing, or you know, those horrible drawings that, you know, it was the last one, the last day of San Diego Con, and you're just so tired, you know. And you get a quick free drawing for somebody, and it's just like, oh, now this is staring me in the face again. but that's a cool site, and I check it out every once in a while just to see what people are posting. Plus, to see all the artwork I've done over the years, that, you know, especially like convention sketches, because it used to be drawn, you know, you hand it to the person an hour later, and you never see it again. So it's a cool mistake. You know, trip down nostalgia.
I have a lot of bad drawings from conventions. Yeah, that's when I started taking my time and doing a good job.
Well, see, I look at them and I go, yeah, but.
So I spent the summer scanning my archives, so I've got a project called the Complete Megaton Man Universe, which will be 600-page volume one, which is Megaton Man, published by Kitchen Sink Press in the 80s. And volume two, which will be Bizarre Heroes, the series I self-published under Fiasco Comics, which Megaton Man essentially took over in the 90s. That'll be 650 pages. That's coming from Fantagraphics Underground.
You're re-scanning all the artwork?
I've done it.
So you didn't have to get the negatives from Dennis. Back then there weren't scanners. They had to photograph your artwork at the printer.
No, I still have most of the artwork. Some photocopies, some films. But there's one thing I'd like to talk about before we leave here, and I purchased this at the show. It's a 20-sided die it's pink. And I look at the package. Now, listen to this. It says girl, gamer, female. Now, why are we gendering? See how far we have to go here with the color pink. Anyway.
I hear you. I just bought a pink Xbox controller.
There we go.
I made it so my daughter wouldn't take it from me. She hates pink.
There you go. Thank you all for spending part of your convention.
Yes, thank you very much. Here. Thank you, Don. Thank you, James. Thank you. It was a blast. And folks, thank you for coming out. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. My conversation with James O. Barr and Don Simpson from the Monroe Pop Fest this past September as part of the Legendary Comics Creator Panel. And I'd like to thank Don and I'd like to thank James for taking some time out of their very busy Friday evening to sit down and be a part of the panel. And I'd like to thank everybody who checked out the panel that evening because it was a pretty decent crowd and I appreciate the support. And with that, I'm going to now let you know where you can get in touch with me if you have a comment about this episode, or any episode for that matter. Well, first of all, if you want to be old school, you can email me. JohnOrlando@PVDcast.com is my email address. You can leave me a note over on the Facebook or Instagram feeds of this podcast. Just search for @PVDcast. And you can even find me on Twitter. My personal Twitter handle is @PVDMVP. Now, if you want to let some folks know where they can hear the PVDcast, well, there's a ton of avenues for that. Obviously, PVDcast.com, the online home of yours truly, is one of the best places to go. But it's also available through all those major podcasting outlets, you know, like Spotify, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio app, Deezer, etc., etc. Just go into your favorite outlet, go to the search bar, put in PVDcast. Sometimes you have to put my name after it. And you should find it. And every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, I give you another option to hear the week's episode. I do that by doing a little Facebook broadcast through the Facebook page. Once again, that's @PVDcast. And you can check out the episode. And if you have comments, you can leave them there. I really do appreciate all the folks that join me every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Try to make it a little bit more interactive and a little more fun for you as you're listening along. But there you go. There's three very good, easy ways to listen to this podcast. But I need a favor from you. If you listen through an app, okay, no matter which one it is, you need to rate and review. It helps me out in the algorithm. I really need the support. It drives me up the charts. I don't know why. I don't know why that's important. It just is. These companies want to know that you're listening. So if you listen through any app, your favorite app, just, you know, give me however many stars you think I deserve and a quick little write-up. That's all you need to do. And for you folks that like to listen through the Facebook page, like it, man. You gotta like it. That helps me out. Again, much like rating and reviewing. If you could do that, I would greatly appreciate it. And of course, by the way, you should always subscribe so that you never miss an episode of the PVDcast. All right, with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to get on out of here. Once again, I thank you for checking out the episode. And with that, I will chat at each and every one of you later. Stay righteous, stay independent, and stay safe and healthy. Presentation of John Orlando Enterprises, LLC, copyright 2022.